Hello and welcome to episode 20 of Investigating the Post Office Scandal. My name is Rebecca Thompson and I wrote the first investigation into the Post Office Horizon IT system for Computer Weekly in 2009.
Hello, my name is Nick Wallace and I am the author of the book The Great Post Office Scandal, paperback version finally out next week.
Exciting times. This is a special non-inquiry episode bringing you an interview with one of the most important characters in the Post Office scandal, Lord James Arbuthnot.
We spoke to Lord Arbuthnot a few weeks ago but got waylaid by matters pertaining to the inquiry, so we're delighted to finally be getting this interview out.
Lord Arbuthnot has been involved in this story since 2008. He was the MP for North East Hampshire and had former sub-postmaster Joe Hamilton as a constituent.
Joe was one of the very first sub-postmasters to begin the fight back against the post office in the mid-2000s after being convicted of false accounting. And Lord Arbuthnot has essentially led the way both as an MP and as a peer, supporting the Justice for Sub-Postmasters Alliance and pushing to get all the sub-postmasters' voices heard. I think he's been absolutely essential in forcing the government and the post office to take Joe and the JFSA seriously at the highest levels. And I think I'm right in saying without him, I don't think they would have got as far as they did, certainly in the early days.
Yeah, he's been really crucial. Over the course of this interview, we cover Lord Arbuthnot's career before Parliament as a barrister, his time as an MP, and how he got involved in the sub-postmasters campaign. We also cover his campaign to have a proper investigation into the Chinook Mullavkuntire air disaster in 1994, which killed 29 people.
Which brought him into contact with your old boss, Tony Collins, at Computer Weekly. And we also speak to Lord Arbuthnot about his bid this year to succeed Tim Parker as chairman of the post office.
I became a lawyer and practiced as a barrister for 15 years before becoming an MP.
Why did you choose that career path?
I was taking the advice of my father. I wanted to keep my options open as to anything that might... being a lawyer is a really good training for lots and lots of different things, and it would have allowed me to do whatever I found I wanted to do in later life. And actually, so it has proved. And it's a very good training for being a politician, because as a politician, you're dealing all the time with representing people, you're dealing with law. And so I found, thanks to my father, who had actually been an MP himself, that it was a very good training for that.
What made you want to become an MP?
In those days, I was interested in power and glory. odd now to think of MPs as having either. Certainly I've lost that motivation over the decades, and I am not in the slightest bit interested in power, except insofar as it allows me to help or do what I can to right the injustices that crop up from time to time. And I've discovered that having been a small boy saying it's not fair, that has not left me. It's become more important to me.
So was there an element of overweening ambition then when you decided to go from being a barrister to an MP?
Well, actually, there was an element of enjoying responsibility. Ambition, yes, certainly. Overweening, probably. But I really enjoyed responsibility when I'd been a local councillor, for example. I enjoyed doing things for other people. And so that was what gave me fulfilment. I don't know why.
Was there an element of noblesse oblige? Did you feel that you were in a position to help people? You could do good things and therefore you should?
Yes. There was also a rather disgraceful element of entitlement, which may come to the same thing. I was head boy of all of the schools I was at. And I thought, well, just carry on.
Is there one thing that you can look back and ascribe that shift from power and glory to injustice and wanting to help, or was it a gradual thing?
It was a gradual thing, but when you become an MP and people come and see you with their problems, and you know you have a part of your job is to see what you can do to put it right, it becomes a mission. And that became my mission. So it was a gradual thing.
I remember you spoke about being a junior minister, which you were. I think you became quite a senior minister at one stage, but you've been quite disparaging about junior ministers and the transience of those positions and the actual responsibility and power that they have. What was it like serving in the government, and what were the frustrations that stopped you from going further or perhaps deciding you didn't want to go any further?
I don't think I would be disparaging about the ministers themselves. They are doing their utmost to do their best, but they find themselves surrounded by history, by the Treasury, by circumstance, which gives them very little agency, much less agency than people who haven't been a minister think that those who are ministers have got. And it's only really when you get into the cabinet or when you are really striking out a different path. Frank Field, who wasn't in the cabinet, did have a considerable degree of agency. And as a result of that, he got sacked as a minister. People who are too unusual, they have a huge influence but don't last long. I was not particularly unusual, and I lasted for some time as a minister. Why did I stop being a minister? Well, for understandable reasons, the country fell out of love with the Conservative Party and got rid of us as a government, and we were out of power then for many years. By the time the Conservatives got back into government, I had lost my wish to be a minister.
Just worth asking, because I may be wrong in this, but did you not serve under Margaret Thatcher? Were you a minister?
No, I was a parliamentary private secretary,
right,
under Margaret Thatcher, but only became a minister under John Major.
I see. Okay, I was just going to ask you about that period of time, because I think it's of historical importance what it was like serving in a government under Margaret Thatcher.
Well, I suppose being a parliamentary private secretary is, in a sense, part of the payroll vote. It's not actually part of the government, but it's part of the payroll vote.
And any reflections on that?
It was, I thought, a very good period of government with an absolutely terrifying Prime Minister who did her very level best for the country and upset a lot of people along the way.
Can I ask why you describe yourself at that time as not unusual, and would you describe yourself as unusual now? Has that changed?
No, that hasn't changed. I mean, I describe myself as not unusual then because I was a, frankly, pretty run-of-the-mill politician. I was a young, legally trained, male, white, ex-public school, Oxbridge politician. I don't think that was frightfully unusual for those times. It's much more unusual now, actually. And probably that's a good thing. Am I unusual now?
Or is your approach unusual, I guess?
I don't think so. I do think that most politicians really do try their best by their own lights to do the best they can for the country.
You spoke about what it's like when people come to see you with issues that they are trying to get resolved. I understand one of the meetings that you had in the 90s was with the parents of the Chinook pilots whose aircraft crashed into the Mull of Kintyre. At what stage were they at when they came to see you? Had they already launched a campaign to try and clear their sons' names, or were they trying to enlist you to help them?
I was in an odd position, in that I'd been a defence minister under John Major until 1997. And one of the defence debates we had in the House of Commons, when I was answering the debate, the issue of the Chinook crash came up, brought up by Martin O'Neill, who was the Labour front bench spokesman for defence at the time. And I gave the government line and rather dismissed what he said. To his fury and my subsequent embarrassment, because then I changed constituencies, because my previous constituency had been abolished by the Boundary Commission, and found myself representing the Odium airfield. And during the election campaign of 1997, I met the parents, two of the fathers of the two pilots who had been killed in that crash. And I suddenly realised that there was something deeply wrong about the government line to take that I had been myself spewing out as a government minister.
When you say suddenly realise, what was it that made you change position or have that realisation?
Well, I went to see John Cook, who was the father of one of the pilots who had died, and he showed me lots of documents that I hadn't had time to read while I was a defence minister. And the logic of what he was saying, and some new arguments that occurred to me as I was talking to him and seeing his documents, struck me as being inescapable. The particular thing was the RAF had rules that stated that only in cases where there was absolutely no doubt whatsoever could deceased pilots be found guilty of negligence. And as a lawyer, it struck me that it was very difficult to find a case where there was absolutely no doubt whatsoever. And it was only in talking to him that that point really struck home to me.
That's really interesting. Tell me about the role of Computer Weekly in the campaign to exonerate the Chinook pilots, or to at least raise very, very serious questions about what had actually happened inside that helicopter.
Well, it may be that John Cook, the father of one of the pilots, showed me an article by Tony Collins. Or it may be that when I then took up the case, as I did, becoming the MP for John Cook, it may be that Tony Collins and I met. I mean, we certainly did meet, but it may be that I read his articles after that. Computer Weekly's role in exposing the flaws in computer evidence at that stage was very important, and it became, to my mind, a really credible source of information. And I still think that Tony Collins is one of the best investigative journalists I have ever met.
The Chinook piece is a stunning piece, or the pieces that he's written about it, including his huge investigation in 2000, is a stunning piece of work. And then, Rebecca, he became your boss, didn't he?
Yeah,
forgive me for starting to interview you, but what was he like to work for?
Just very inspiring. Yeah, One of the best people I've worked with, 100%.
I just want to know whether or not your paths crossed before you published your seminal piece of journalism, Rebecca, for Computer Weekly on the post office scandal. Did you interview Lord or James Arbuthnot, as he was then?
I don't think I did, James. Do you?
I don't think so.
I did. I spoke to Joe, but I can't remember why I didn't interview you.
So your first awareness of the piece was presumably reading it or having you pointed towards it by someone else, Lord Arbuthnot. How did it come across your desk?
It was probably Joe Hamilton, the sub-postmaster from South Warnborough, who was my constituent, who said that Computer Weekly was interested, and that pricked my ears up. But I can't remember when I first knew about that.
Because I remember interviewing you in 2015, and you said on reading that and knowing what you knew about not just Joe Hamilton, but also you had another constituent in Odium who had been through a similar situation. You described that investigation as galvanising you, making you realise that this wasn't just a little local difficulty. This could be happening all over the country. And it was largely because of the reputation that Tony Collins had built up at Computer Weekly that made you think, right, they wouldn't just print this without having good reason to.
Yes. Sorry, I've just remembered. It was in 2009, November 2009, Computer Weekly came to my attention. So I did raise that issue then, both with Lord Mandelson, who was the Secretary of State for Business, Innovation and Skills, and with a senior figure who lived in my constituency again in the National Federation of Sub-Postmasters, about both the Computer Weekly articles and about the problems that had been raised with me by the sub-postmaster in Odium and the sub-postmaster David Brister, yeah. And the sub-postmaster Joe Hamilton in South Warnborough. And actually, it later transpired that two other sub-postmasters in my constituency also had horizon problems but didn't want me to take them any further.
I believe you told me that Nipi Singh, the National Federation of Sub-Postmasters representative, was quite dismissive of your concerns initially.
Yes. Well, he always said, when I talked to him about it, that he thought that this was a fair cop, that these people must have been doing something wrong with Horizon, and that the post office was in the right.
What was Lord Mandelson's response?
I can't remember that it... Well, I haven't kept a copy of that, but I don't think it was a significant response. Nothing that I've got a copy of, anyway. Maybe that's something that could be discovered by Freedom of Information inquiries.
What was it about the post office case overall that kind of got you interested in the first place? Obviously, I know it was those personal stories, but what was it that made you stick with it, become more interested in it more broadly?
Well, I'd had two sub-postmasters ask me to help. One of them had already pleaded guilty, and the other sort of dropped off my radar and said there was nothing further to be done. And so from the end of 2009 until I think maybe 2011, there was nothing very much that happened. But in February 2011, when Nipi Singh was standing for election to the National Federation of Sub-Postmasters, he asked me to speak to Ed Davey about the government's plans for the post office, which I did. Ed Davey was the post office minister who was in charge of the post office.
And this was a Liberal Democrat coalition, wasn't it? The Conservative.
Yes, it was. He was a Lib Dem. He was a Lib Dem MP, and he was a minister in the coalition. So I began to talk to Ed Davey about the post office, but I also, apparently, from what I can remember, raised the issue of unexplained irregularities. And then the thing that galvanised me was that in Odeum, where David Bristow had been the first person to raise it with me, David Bristow had been removed as the sub-postmaster. But then exactly the same thing began to happen to his successor. And I thought, hey, this is obviously wrong. Because although the replacement sub-postmaster did not himself ask me to pursue the issue, some of the residents of Odeum began to complain because the Odeum post office was closed. And so I wrote to the minister to ask what was happening. The solicitors who had acted for Joe Hamilton, shoesmiths in Basingstoke, said that they had 34 similar cases. And this was obviously becoming something of a groundswell. And so at that stage, I had to take it up as a matter of much more importance than two people, one pleading guilty and the other dropping off my radar. Obviously, it was a larger issue that needed to be pursued in the country as a whole. And so I suggested to the solicitors, shoesmiths, that I should write to all MPs to ask if they'd had something similar to happen to them. And I, as a result, set up a meeting with MPs and sub-postmasters to see what was going on.
That's really interesting, because I was sort of starting to get interested in the story at around that time. I was very lucky, of course, because when I met Devinder Misra, Seema Misra's husband, the Justice for Sub-Postmasters Alliance already existed. Rebecca's brilliant article was already in the public domain. So I had an awful lot more to go on than perhaps Rebecca did in the early days. I had perhaps the most egregious case that I'd come across, a pregnant woman being sent to prison, saying it was for a crime she didn't commit. And I'm just interested, because it's very easy with retrospect to see what a big story this was. But at the time, there wasn't much in the way of hard evidence to prove what the sub-postmasters were saying. There were large numbers and growing numbers of them. And I just wondered, when you first thought, my goodness, we potentially have some very serious miscarriages of justice on our hands, because it's a calculation that I've sort of simplified in retrospect, which was either all these people are lying, or we are looking at very serious miscarriages of justice. Miscarriages of justice don't happen that often in the criminal courts, you would hope. Certainly not ones that land in journalists' laps in the way that this had. I just wondered when you thought, hang on a minute, if these people are telling the truth, we've got something more serious than many other things that are in my in tray right now.
It was as early in 2009, when I'd had a meeting with David Jones, another MP who had a problem with his, which had been raised by one of his constituents, namely Alan Bates, who ran the entire Justice for Sub-Postmasters Alliance. It was in 2009 that I told him that I felt a campaign coming on. But actually, that campaign sort of petered out, because nothing more happened. And it was only when, in 2011, when Shoesmith said, we've got 34 more, that it struck me that must be, that this can't be a coincidence. Something must be seriously wrong.
Do you have any sense of why more people at this stage, either in your position or within the post office, didn't pick up on this in the same way that you were picking up on it? Because obviously evidence was starting to creep out. The post office had evidence of its own, you know, evidence of complaints. Do you have any sense of why people didn't take it more seriously in the same way that you were?
I don't really. And the post office was making the good point that, hey, look, there may be some issues with some sub-postmasters, but the vast majority of transactions are being well handled and create no problems. And if that vast majority of transactions are being well handled, and you have to assume that sub-postmasters might be dishonest, leave it to the courts. The court system is a good system. It will get to the bottom of these things sooner or later. And it's quite difficult for MPs to interfere in a court system that is widely respected and which, on the whole, until this ghastly saga, has worked pretty well. So that may be it, but I don't know.
I'm tempted to gloss over the mediation scheme because I do really want to bring us up to speed as to where we are now and of course, the way the post office behaved in the light of what we now know of the Swift report, etc. But I think we should touch on it briefly because your efforts in persuading Alice Perkins and Paula Venables, alongside Alan Bates and your fellow MPs, to start the mediation scheme and get Second Sight in to do their investigation was, I think, the trigger from which everything else unravelled, if that's not mixing a metaphor. How do you view that period now?
I think you're right that it began the ball rolling. And I think it began the ball rolling because I think Alice Perkins and Paula Venables genuinely thought, from what I could tell from my own knowledge of human beings.
And we ought to mention for people who are new to this that Alice Perkins was the incoming chair of the post office and Paula Venables was the newly appointed chief executive of the post office at that time, back in 2012, 2013.
And they had me and Oliver Letwin, another MP who had concerns about this, to a meeting at the post office headquarters. And it was Paula Venables, who herself suggested that what we needed in order to allay the concerns that we all, those four of us, felt about the Horizon system, what we needed was a firm of forensic accountants to look into everything, overturn the stones, see what was underneath, and we could all then be either reassured or things could be put right. I believe that Alice Perkins and Paula Venables entered into this investigation with the best possible of intentions, namely to get to the bottom of it. And it was, I think, because Second Sight began to come up with answers that the post office didn't like, that people within the post office, possibly people with vested interests, I don't know, went to the chairman and the chief executive, Alice Perkins and Paula Venables, and said, we can't expose this, because if we do, it will be an existential matter for the entire post office. And I think that that's actually what happened. And as a result, their best intentions got overturned by having answers that they didn't like.
I wonder who, it sounds very conspiratorial to say that they were got at, but they clearly were, because the whole tone their response to Second Sight's investigation changed in late 2013. And one hopes that the statutory inquiry will be asking precisely those questions. What conversations did Alice Perkins and Paula Venables have, and with whom? That changed the tenor of the way they dealt with Second Sight and the sub-postmasters and MPs like yourself going forward. But before we sort of start to speculate that, because I wonder whether or not there was pressure from above, pressure from the government saying, what are you doing? Essentially, what are you doing? You've let these two independent investigators inside the building and they've gone rogue by uncovering things that we'd rather they didn't. I mean, it's very hard to imagine how that kind of... Well, maybe it's not hard to imagine how that kind of scenario could develop, but when you start to boil down to who said what when and what the specificities are, that's just not known, not recorded, or if it is, it hasn't been made public yet.
Indeed, but there's a lot that hasn't been made public yet. I mean, since Jonathan Swift produced a report that was then hidden not just from the public but from the Post Office Board, it makes us wonder, is there a lot more, even worse stuff yet to come out? But your question about whether the government put pressure on the Post Office to sack Second Sight and to remove and essentially to say that there's nothing to see here is a good one, but I hope that Sir Wynn will get to the bottom of it. I have never actually alleged that that's what happened. What I have alleged and do believe is that it was the government's, the civil service and ministers' duty to be very firmly in control of what the Post Office was doing. And they may have pressurised the Post Office to suppress things. But even if they didn't, it was their duty to avoid miscarriages of justice and to get to the bottom of what the Post Office was actually doing. And they failed in that duty.
And before we move on, because I'd like to get to the Swift review, because that is a new document that was made public in August this year, which was no one really knew anything about it. Just a word about Ron Warmington and Ian Henderson and the team from Second Sight and the work that they did, because both are quite bullish characters, but it's perhaps taken me some time to realise what enormous pressure they must have been under, their professional reputations and the amount of and level of work that they were doing, and how it was so completely at odds with what the Post Office was saying. And yet they stuck to their guns throughout. And I think they've been almost, well, I think completely exonerated and wholly vindicated in the work that they've done.
Not only do they stick to their guns, they have been proven right in everything they said. And they came under real pressure, not just from the Post Office demanding that they say things which were untrue, but also from the Post Office keeping from them information and documents that the Post Office had previously promised to give them, making it very, very difficult for them to do the job for which the Post Office had chosen them. And they also came under pressure from MPs. MPs, we were obviously suspicious of this firm of forensic accountants that had been hand-picked by the Post Office management.
Yes, I think they were recommended by the Post Office General Counsel to the board.
They were recommended by Susan Crichton, who had been the Post Office's General Counsel until a time when Second Sight began to produce answers that the Post Office didn't like, and then Susan Crichton stopped being the Post Office's general counsel. I mean, it's so easy to get into all sorts of conspiracy theories here. But nevertheless, your point about Second Sight having withstood intense pressure, come up with the right answers, and then being sacked for their pains is absolutely right.
So in 2015, Baroness Neville Rolfe, who was, I believe, newly appointed as Postal Affairs Minister, asked the incoming chairman of the Post Office, Tim Parker, to again have a proper look at what had been going on in the light of, I think she mentioned, the Panorama programme, which went out in August of 2015. This was a review carried out by Jonathan Swift QC and a junior barrister. Jonathan Swift QC had just stopped being, I think, First Treasury Counsel, which is a very, very senior, important legal job within the government. And he went about putting together his review, which was only made public due to a Freedom of Information request in August this year. I don't know whether you've had a chance to read the Swift review. I note that you were one of the people Jonathan Swift spoke to for his review. What are your recollections of that conversation, if any? And what are your thoughts on the Swift review's conclusions?
Well, Baroness Neville Rolfe had a meeting with me because I was saying this is all going seriously wrong in September 2015. I should think that as, because the meeting that I had with her was on the 17th of September, on the 10th of September, in other words, a week before that meeting, she had written to Tim Parker, the chairman, the new chairman of the post office, asking him to investigate the matter. Whether that was because she knew she had a meeting with me, or it was because of the Panorama programme, I should think it was a combination of both. So I can't remember much about my meeting with Baroness Neville Rolfe, but she has ever since that episode said in public, in Parliament, she has said that she had simply told the post office, for God's sake, sort this out. This is obviously wrong. And I take her at her word for this. So, in roundabout, I can't remember exactly when, December, December that year, 2015, I had a meeting with Tim Parker. At that meeting, he brought along Jonathan Swift, a senior barrister, and Christopher Knight, who was probably another barrister, but I can't remember. I told him that I thought that the post office had behaved in a way which was completely outrageous, that it had sabotaged its own mediation scheme, that it was running seriously close to suppressing possible miscarriages of justice, and that it would be sorted out in the long run. It's just a question of whether they wanted to bite the bullet now and avoid a lot of trouble, or fight on and fight to win. And he, Tim Parker, took that all in, didn't say very much. Jonathan Swift said very little. And they went about their way. And I gather that they had similar meetings with Ron Warmington and Ian Henderson of Second Sight, and almost certainly with others as well.
It does make you wonder, because there are things that are perhaps worth fighting for, but I would have thought if there was the vaguest sniff of a miscarriage of justice somewhere along the line, then everyone should be working together to pull up as many trees as you can to find out whether or not one had taken place, rather than treating it as a form of litigation, as something that you get to win or not.
Yes, that is my view. And I had said on the Today programme about a year earlier that one miscarriage of justice should have the country up in arms, which is what I still think. But the number of miscarriages of justice that were popping up all over the place was obviously one that should galvanise the post office. It didn't, but it obviously should have done.
The conclusions of the Swift Review, which was delivered to the chairman in early 2016, were that it was highly possible, possibly even probable, that the post office had been responsible for, at the very least, bullying people into accepting guilty pleas or making guilty pleas to crimes they may not have committed. So that's putting it mildly. I think Jonathan Swift was perhaps even stronger in his language than that. The chairman of the post office received the report from Jonathan Swift and did not deliver it to the post office board, which he was admonished for 4 years later. To me, that meant the post office board was not in possession of essential information as it was about to embark on a multi-million pound civil litigation against the sub-postmasters. What's your view of the actions of Tim Parker in this?
It's a quite extraordinary approach to corporate governance. How is a board meant to take crucial decisions without the information on which to take those decisions? And for that information not just to be unavailable, but to be available but suppressed, strikes me as being worthy of more than a rebuke from the permanent secretary of the relevant government department. It is an appalling way to run any organisation. And I think, I told Tim Parker this halfway through the litigation, I thought that he ought to resign then. I think the entire board that was involved in the litigation that followed the Swift report should have, if not resigned, been sacked. But actually, one has to say about the Swift Review that it was right in the respect in relation to the miscarriages of justice, for those who, like Joe Hamilton, my constituent, for example, were bullied into accepting saying they should plead guilty to false accounting for fear of being prosecuted for theft. That was an outrageous act by the post office, but the Swift Review got completely wrong the issues that Mr. Justice Fraser later got right in the High Court action brought by Alan Bates, which the post office now does not question. So one shouldn't praise too highly the Swift Review. There were things which were seriously wrong with it, but it did nevertheless bring to the attention of at least the chairman of the post office that there was something that needed to be put right here, and he personally failed to put it right.
Do you remember any response from him when you told him mid-litigation that you thought he should resign?
He said that it wasn't his fault, he wasn't a lawyer. And I said, well, your lawyers should have been sacked. And they had been.
And Tim Parker has very recently gone sailing off into the sunset with the best wishes of the then business minister, Kwasi Kwarteng, ringing in his ears. We have a new post office chairman, Henry Staunton, who's come across from WH Smith. I mean, that struck me as a job that you might have gone for, Lord Arbuthnot.
Well, Mr. Staunton is a much better candidate than I was. I did go for it, but the government decided, for perfectly understandable reasons, that I was not the right person to do it.
What was your pitch?
My pitch was that the the post office's reputation needs to be restored across the board, including with the sub-postmasters, who cannot be expected to trust a word that the post office says. And that although my experience in big industry may not be as great as some, I would help to restore that reputation, particularly with the sub-postmasters, and the post office could then move on with a clean slate. But I'm perfectly happy with the appointment of Mr. Staunton. I think he's got a degree of experience of corporate governance which ought to enable him to put things right in a way which they really, really need to be.
Were you interviewed for the post?
No.
So your application didn't make it too far. And it strikes me that something this serious, a miscarriage of justice this serious on this scale, would lead to some form of, even if it was a mass resignation of the board after the 2019 judgment came through. There doesn't seem to have been any appetite at the very highest levels of government to say to the board, you've got this wrong on so many different levels. It's time you left your jobs and we got someone else in. It just hasn't happened, has it? I mean, Paula Venables left with the CBE in the middle of the litigation, and she has voluntarily stepped down from her own positions over the last 2 years. No one said, we don't want you here anymore, to any executive at any level.
There may be a reason for that. And that may be that the permanent secretary of the business, energy and industrial strategy department is the accounting officer for the post office. And so a succession of senior civil servants have got responsibility to oversee everything that the government is doing. And the more they dig into what the post office is doing. So the more they dig into what the post office has done, the more they may find that the permanent secretary of that key department, which owns the post office, carries a large degree of responsibility. And there's also, of course, a government-appointed director on the board of the post office. So the government bears responsibility for these things, and I think that's one of the reasons that the government is stepping up to, all too slowly, to issue compensation for some of the sub-postmasters who have been so badly treated.
Do you think there's a democratic deficit here? Because the civil servants who appear to have been running the show, certainly they were in charge of the information that was making it to ministers and they were receiving information from the post office. You can't interview them. They can't be held to account by journalists. And it's ministers who have to answer in Parliament. Yet they're not always have sight of what's actually going on in the departments that they're supposed to be running. And they're dependent on the civil servants for the information that they get. To what extent do you hold the civil service responsible for a lot of what has gone wrong in this case?
Well, in the end, it has to be ministers who answer for their civil servants. One of the things that worries me is that I strongly believe that some ministers, some junior ministers, were expressly told by their senior civil servants, do not get involved in this. This is a matter that is for the courts, and it has to be outside ministerial interference. And so democratic deficit, that's a good way of putting it, this fell between far too many cracks.
Do you have any kind of sense of disillusionment around this whole case? Do you think it's sort of one colossal anomaly, or is there sort of some sense of a loss of faith in where either the civil service, government works?
Disillusionment. I don't really have time for that. My approach really is, you've got to keep on battering at the system that you have, try to change it to the extent that you can in order to put things right. The previous post office minister, Paul Scully, who sadly now is not in his job, I think made a genuine, strong attempt to get compensation flowing. And he fought, I think, against quite entrenched positions to get the inquiry underway and to get compensation flowing. And so there are, as I say, good people working to do their best. But there are people also working in the background to try to cover up their own role. And one has to fight through it all to get to the right answer. It just takes too long.
So Nick assures me that I don't sound too bonkers when I ask this question, but do you think that there are any sort of strands or similarities between other recent scandals, so Grenfell, Windrush, the way people are perceived, the way people are listened to? Do you think there's sort of anything linking? Because there have been some pretty terrible scandals in recent years with people being treated as certainly on a par as the way they were treated in the post office.
Well, yes, I do. I mean, it's all a matter of the human condition, in a way. People don't like listening to bad news. People want to believe that things are not going wrong, even if they are going wrong. And there's also a matter of short-termism. People don't like thinking about things far off in the future. So there's a mixture of human behaviours that have contributed to this. Some of which we've discussed this morning.
So nothing particularly English, would you say, about it?
No, I don't think so. Possibly an excess of deference.
I wonder if I might be able to pick up on that, because, like it or not, you are an establishment figure. You believe and you trust in our institutions, because if we don't believe in our institutions, then society fails. But as a journalist, I've seen so many times how our great institutions fail the people it's supposed to serve. And things never seem to improve. People are never held properly accountable for the bad decisions they made, or the decisions they made in bad faith that allowed them to cover up wrongdoing, which protected them and the people they know and the people who operate in the same circles as them, and allow the weakest in society to keep getting punished or destroyed. I mean, I'm thinking of the infected blood scandal or the Grenfell disaster as much as the post office scandal, Windrush. These are defenceless people who do not have the resources to protect themselves, and they seem to be let down time and time again by bad decision making. And the reason we keep having bad decision making is because we have a system that does not properly hold people accountable for their actions. I wondered if your view has changed on that over the years, or whether you'd agree with that.
I am an establishment person. I don't think I would agree with it. And the two great campaigns that I've been involved in, first the Chinook crash, and second this post office scandal, the Chinook crash was eventually resolved at the end of an inquiry which found that the pilots who had been blamed for negligence should be exonerated. The post office scandal is now being inquired into by a man in whom I have faith, Sir Wynne Williams. And I hope and expect that, first, he will do his utmost to get to the bottom of it, and that, second, if he doesn't, there will be another form of redress. So I am not as pessimistic as you. The Grenfell scandal is being inquired into. The Windrush scandal has been inquired into. Even the pandemic is being inquired into. And I think it takes too long, which is why people feel there isn't sufficient accountability. But I believe that in the end, justice is done. It's just those words, "in the end," that trouble me. It takes too long.
Justice delayed is justice denied.
In terms of where we go from here, the inquiry is about to restart. How are you feeling about the inquiry, the overall case at the moment? What would you say are the sort of key questions for the inquiry as it gets into its next phase? What's the next part of the case for you?
So Wynne Williams has issued a very good video. Problems with the sound recording. Okay, we accept that. A very good video about where we go from here. And he has expressly talked about the harrowing stories that we've heard from the sub-postmasters themselves. But the key thing is, why did the post office do as it did? Who could have stopped them? Who knew what, when, and what did they do with that information? And I think that it is essential that he asks the questions that he's got well in his mind, that he's set out in a huge long list of questions, and that he does it without any fear of the consequences. We've got to get to the bottom of this, because this is the largest miscarriage of justice in British history. But hundreds of people were shamed, humiliated, bankrupted, imprisoned, some committed suicide. And if we don't get to the bottom of it, it's going to happen again. And so we've got to get to the bottom of it. I think he will, actually.
Are you confident that the compensation issue, which is, of course, the main priority for most of the sub-postmasters, I think I'm right in saying none of whom have received full and final compensation for any plus six-figure claims, is also a priority? And do you have the confidence that it will be resolved within the next 12 months, as ministers have hinted it will be?
I always worry about the timing. So I'm not going to express any confidence about the next 12 months. Do I think it will be resolved? Yes, I do. But how do you compensate people whose loved ones have died in shame? How do you compensate people who have committed suicide, or how do you compensate their families for that? They know that they went to their graves without being exonerated and without seeing their lives restored to what they should have been. So that is intrinsically impossible. And there's a lot of ground that the government and the post office have got to make up.
And what about you? When you look back on your very long and interesting career, what do you look back on as something that you can take most satisfaction out of?
Oh, without question, the Chinook campaign and the post office campaign. But in practice, I have nudged the post office campaign along from time to time. For example, I suggested that the Bayes Select Committee should do an inquiry, and then I suggested that there should be a follow-up inquiry into compensation. And all of these things have helped. But what I do, what select committees do, what MPs do, is help in the margins. The person actually who really has made a difference in this issue is Alan Bates, who led the Justice for Sub-Postmasters Alliance, and who took the government and the post office to court and won. I helped him do that because MPs and I, in our campaign within Parliament, gave him a credibility in getting funding for his litigation. You, Nick and Rebecca, helped him with that because of your articles, and you particularly, Nick and Rebecca, have brought this scandal to the light and to the attention of the public, which has helped. But I think Alan Bates is the hero in this.
I couldn't agree more, and I very much hope we'll get General Bates on the Investigating the Post Office Scandal podcast before too long. Lord Arbuthnot, thank you very much indeed for your time.
Thank you.
And I'm delighted to say that in another Investigating the Post Office Scandal exclusive, Lord Arbuthnot has kindly agreed to become patron of the Horizon Scandal Fund, a charity that was set up to help sub-postmasters in need by my publishers. That's going to be formally announced next week. But there you go, that's your reward for listening to the end of this very lengthy podcast.
We'll be back on Friday with another inquiry roundup. Is there anything you want to plug, Nick?
Very kind of you to ask, Rebecca. Thank you. I am going to be at the Kenton Theatre in Henley-on-Thames on Thursday, the 10th of November. So that's in 2 days' time. Talking, if you are listening to this the day it comes out, on Tuesday the 8th of November. So I'm going to be there on the 10th of November talking about the post office scandal. And if you live near Norwich, I'll be at the Playhouse on Monday the 21st of November doing the same. And if you can, please do buy the paperback version of The Great Post Office Scandal when it comes out next week. It's been updated to cover the last 12 months worth of shenanigans, and it's retailing for £13.99.
Lovely. There's always something to plug, which is nice.
There is, yes. Well, it's nice to have things going on, I guess.
It certainly is. Okay, that's it for episode 20 of Investigating the Post Office Scandal.
Thank you very much for listening. Don't forget to like, subscribe and follow so you get each new episode as soon as it drops.
Investigating the Post Office Scandal is produced and presented by Rebecca Thompson and Nick Wallace, with sage advice and support from Whistledown and Productions. Thanks for listening. Bye.